Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moor pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon, all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Hey, music nerds, welcome to the show. This is episode 112 with my guest today, the great upright bassist, side person, and composer Victor Kraus. I hope everyone is getting by all right. Things are moving along here. I'm pretty excited and nervous to start a new studio build here at Hen House headquarters. That's been a year or so in the making, finding someone to do the plans and the build and getting a loan in place, and frankly, just building up the nerve to get my studio built here after moving across town to East Nashville. And for the last year or so, I've just been mixing and recording remotely and haven't needed a space to do anything more than that. But that's starting to change, and I think the time has come. So I'm diving in, and that's what's happening here. I think I might document the process a little bit. They're going to start demoing some of the old walls and stuff next week. So if you're interested in such things and studio building and whatnot, keep your eye on my YouTube page, and I will probably post some videos of that process as it goes along. I should also mention that I'm going to be releasing 3 new albums next year, starting in March. Why 3? I don't know. It just happened. I just recorded a whole ton of stuff last year, and I'm going to put it all out. And they are finished, but I don't really have enough money to print the vinyl. I do want to print vinyl, and it's expensive. So anyway, I started a Kickstarter campaign to basically pre-sell the vinyl. And if you would like a copy of some of my new music, I would greatly appreciate it if you would go and have a look and consider a pre-order. It's all right on the front page at stevedawson.ca. And before we get going this week, I would just like to thank the recent financial supporter of the show who chipped in over the last week and or couple weeks, I guess, and we couldn't do it without you. So thanks to Marcy Loomis. Much appreciated. All right, today's guest is Victor Kraus, another fellow Nashvillian and someone that's been on my radar for a good many years now, originally due to his involvement in a string of Bill Frisell records that were huge for me. Those were Gone Just Like a Train, Nashville, Good Dog, Happy Man, and Dis Farmer. That's not in their correct order, but those are the records that really did it for me. And his sound is massive and unmistakable on those records. And I was reminded of that actually just yesterday when I was testing out some new speakers and I put on Blues for Los Angeles off Gone Just Like a Train. Holy crap. Put that one on and crank it. You will not regret it. Anyway, Victor's also made some really cool solo records. He made a wicked duo record that you should check out with a harpist named Maeve Gilchrist. It's called Vignette, I think. And not to mention, he's played on countless sessions for artists like Jerry Douglas, Dolly Parton, Peter Rowan, Sarah Jarosz, Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, The Chieftains. And to cap it all off, he's held down the bass chair in Lyle Lovett's band for well over 20 years. Going on 25. Might even be 25. I can't remember. And his little sister is Alison Krauss. Not too shabby of a resume for Victor. His sound, touch, and tone are totally unique, and I wanted to talk to him about how he plays, how he approaches sessions, some of the nerdy points about his gear, his new studio that he's just put together in Nashville, and lots more. You can see what Victor is up to at victorkraus.com. That's Victor with a K and Kraus with a K. victorkraus.com. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Victor Kraus. So I've got a new season of this podcast starting next week, actually with Peter Rowan, who you've played with. And
oh, God, yeah, that's great.
He's got a few tales, that guy.
Yeah, boy, that was fun. That was a interesting run with him. I enjoyed it. I was thinking,
what did you do with him? Like, were you in his band for a while or what?
I mean, it was one of the first when I moved from Champaign. He was kind of like my first guy that I was touring with when I first moved to Nashville, it was just about a year and a half that I did stuff with him, and it was one of my favorite concerts ever. Was when we did a Telluride, and it was it was recorded and it was actually put out as a record, but it was Telluride in 93, and so it was Jerry Douglas, Sam Bush, Larry Adamaniuk on drums, and Kester Smith, and we just kind of like did his greatest hits, and it was just like a big rock show. It was like one of the best shows one of my favorite shows ever.
How did you hook up with him? Like, did you just run into him around Nashville or?
Well, no, I ended up, when I first moved to town, you know, I would go out on certain tours just to hang out with my sister. And I think he was opening for her.
Oh, okay.
Or I can't remember which one it was. So this would have been like 92, 93.
Yeah.
They shared the same management company, Keith Case and Associates.
Oh, okay.
And they, you know, kind of put a good word in for me. And
yeah.
Yeah. And so then I would come up and play on a couple of tunes on Allison's set. And they said, oh, okay, well, that sounds good. And he seemed like, he was always kind of willing to try different things. And when I ended up kind of having like a formal audition with him later on, and we started playing together, and it's really fun.
So some of those guys that you mentioned, Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas, are people that you've had long standing playing relationships with now, like 25, 30, whatever it is, 30 years later. Yeah. Was that kind of your first exposure to those guys, or did you know them from earlier?
I knew them from prior. Especially, from my sister working with them always kind of, I didn't have that much contact with them. And then I'm associated with being, the sibling of the one who's already has a very credible career. You
have to
prove yourself in a little bit. So that was kind of my first time of being kind of like, okay, this guy is okay. They thinking, okay, that I'm okay. And then obviously when I started working with Lyle Lovett for years, we would then play a lot together, and pretty much right at the same time that I was starting with Lyle, the trio with Douglas Barenberg Meyer, the thing they did with that was
Hop, Skip and Wobble. Is that the one?
Yeah. They weren't going to do that anymore. And then they kind of asked if I'd want to try doing like a version of that. And so I did some stuff with Jerry and Russ.
And okay.
That didn't really turn into, like I wasn't then like the partner of that trio, but we did some stuff together. And then certain years I'd be in Jerry's band and I couldn't do it, for a little while, and then somebody else would do it. And then they couldn't do it. And then I would come back and I'd be in his band again, which was always, it was always more fun to be in his band than not in his band.
It's so interesting with some of those guys who Frizzell comes to mind, who I want to talk about in greater length in a bit, but Jerry Douglas is another guy, and Sam Bush, who, from somebody who's like a music fan and just sort of watching and like aware to a certain extent of what's going on, but not keeping super close tabs on everybody's career. It just seems so wild to me how crazy little configurations will just keep popping up through time. Like I was sort of going down the Victor Crouse rabbit hole this morning on YouTube, and I found a clip of you and Jerry Douglas and Omar Hakim playing together. And it's like, where the hell did that come from?
I try to figure out how that came about. I think there was somebody who, I think it was either management that kind of thought that might be a fun, configuration to do. That was really, really fun. And, I kind of think of myself as a rock guy a lot of the time. I like playing loud.
Right.
And so that was kind of our, giant monster band.
And Jerry likes playing loud too.
Oh yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, especially with the lap steel and just being, it was such a fun pairing.
Was that particular configuration, like just sort of taking that as a random example, like was that something that you guys were touring with at as a trio for a while, or was that just like some weird festival throw together thing that happened?
We actually did quite a bit of dates with that.
Oh, wow.
And it was, not like for long stints of time, but we would do, I think it kind of, it existed for, I think, close to a year, but
wow. Okay.
Just like random dates or little short runs.
You never made a record like that?
No, the only thing that, there's two songs on the Traveler record that have that.
Speaking of Omar Hakim, I am interested, like from your perspective about, you've played with such amazing drummers throughout your career. Keltner comes to mind, Omar Hakim, Steve Gadd, Steve Jordan. Those guys don't play necessarily with upright players a lot. Could you maybe just first talk a little bit about your experience playing with some of these guys and what you love about certain drummers and maybe who some of your favorites are to have played with over the years?
Well, another one is one really fun is Russ Conkle for
sure.
Just with Lyle and
boy,
I mean, they all bring different things, and and Matt Chamberlain's another one that's really great too. I don't know, like with Russ, it's almost like, you know, and you hear those records, you know, that he, you know, his library of work. I remember I recorded with him first before playing with him live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it just, you know, it just sounds completely like him. It's his touch. It's his sense of, it's almost some of those fills that he invented, you know, that became the blueprint for so many drummers, you know, right, that had come after him. But I remember when we played live together, I was just like, okay, well, you know, this sounds like Russ Kunkel in the studio and it's great. And then we played live and it's like, oh, it still sounds like him. You know, it's, you know, it's the beautiful tom sound and the beautiful snare and, you know, and just his sensitivity to the person. He's like, you know, like one of the ultimate support players. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, like, if you think of one element, you think of the you know, the rods on the toms and those tom fills that are just so expressive and meaningful. You know, that's probably one of the things that I've, you know, if you think classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so, you know, it's just so easy. Steve Jordan, before Russ started playing with him live all the time, Steve had did a couple fill-in dates for Lyle.
Oh, and wow.
I had actually recorded with him a couple times before asking him to play on my first solo album.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that kind of the command and, you know, and, you know, and what you think of as the snare drum, you know, that total conviction and...
I'll say.
And we've worked together a little bit since then, but, you know, it's just, it's kind of like, okay, you want, I don't know, it's what you would expect it to feel like, you know, right. Just after hearing him on so many records and just his whole personality that comes through in his playing. And I don't know, it's probably the same thing with all of those guys, you know.
Yeah,
it's just,
yeah. It's
almost like, you know, if they're like hiring a brilliant actor, you know, that you want, okay, well, I want this person. I want it to be this person. And it is that. They can't help.
Yeah, totally. I would imagine that when you first played with some of those guys, you were kind of unknown at the time. Like now, you know, if somebody's going to do a gig and you're on it, it's like, okay, Victor Krauss, they know what they're in for. But, but in, you know, in the early 90s and stuff, you were starting to play with a lot of these guys and they wouldn't necessarily have known of you or whatever at that point. Was that like, how did you feel about that? Like, as a musically, was it intimidating or like, did you feel a real obligation to like lock in with the drummers because you were playing with such crazy good?
Oh gosh. You know, that's a good question. I mean, like, I think some people were more intimidating than others, but at the same time, I kind of knew I had to deliver, I didn't really think of it that much. You know, it's just like, well, here's a great musician and let's see what happens, you know. And most of the time it was just kind of like, well, okay, I mean, they're so great, and you know, you just kind of can't help but feel like, well, the answers are all kind of laid out here for you, you know, and here's what you do. And
great drummers have a way of doing that, don't they?
Yeah, like, yeah,
sort of laying it out for you.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just like yeah, it's just like, okay, well, I can plug into this. And it's really, really fun. You know, I mean, I was thinking about the first, you know, and most of these guys are really nice.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, if not all of them, you know, where it's just, you know, it's not so much what you bring as a musician, but it's just that you're easy to deal with as a human being. And they're not going to go, okay, well, I'm so-and-so and I can, you know, rest on everything that I've done previous to this and have every right to be not a nice person, or, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know if that's the way to go, but they you know, they can afford to, but they're not, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a recurring theme through history, basically, is like a lot of the really successful, great players are also super nice people. And that's what I find too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could we just talk a bit about your space there? Because I've seen some pictures. You know, you've been good about like posting the progress of that on Instagram and stuff. And I'm just curious, like, partly about the space, but also like what your intentions are and how you kind of tailored it towards what you're doing these days, like as far as the setup goes and the equipment.
Well, when we built this space here,
love those ceilings.
Yeah. Well, it's about 18 feet tall.
Wow.
We got diffusers and sound panels and all that kind of stuff all over the place. And I'm a bit of a, gear junkie.
I can see.
Just lots of old synthesizers and pedals and guitars. And and in fact, actually, there's less stuff in here than usual because I'm actually today, later this afternoon in this, I don't know where I'm, oh yeah, this space right here, I'm putting in a Gretsch set.
Oh, cool.
So I can have, so there'll always be drums here.
Is it all one room or is there another room attached to it?
Yes, there's another room. Here, I'll go. We have it set up as three different rooms, and then there's a bathroom. But we've recorded drums in this space before, but it's more or less a lounge.
Oh, wow, cool.
But we have it wired, so drums do sound pretty good in here. Uh-huh. And then I should have unlocked this, but then just a separate isolation for vocalists and then anything that really needs to be separated. But
You got a few axes there, I see.
Yeah. I kind of have a bad habit, as a lot of musicians do, in terms of gear.
That's a good investment, man.
Yeah, well, that's what I tell my wife. And
it's better than playing the damn stock market.
Yeah. I don't play golf and I usually don't spend my per diem on the road to buy stuff. But we had it in our house for years, all this stuff.
Okay.
And it was kind of time to not have clients be in the house. And
right.
And we always wanted to have, we live kind of we live close to kind of Vanderbilt and Belmont University. So it's a little bit of a noisy neighborhood. So I'd have to, since most of the time that I record the big bass, the upright bass that I, I'd have to really kind of pick hours and tell people to be quiet in the house so much construction all the time that we really needed to get it out. And we've been wanting to do this for years and years. And so
is that space a freestanding building somewhere, or where are you?
I'm just in the back of our house. So it's a freestanding building.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's a detached structure from your house.
Yeah. It was, we're really happy with how it turned out.
And did you build it from scratch, or was that a building that was already there?
Yeah. We built it from the ground up.
Oh, wow. That's a huge undertaking.
Yeah. It was big. It was, I think we had started plans for it as early as late 2017.
Okay.
Thought, well, maybe we shouldn't do this. And then we decided, well, okay. And then by the time we started breaking ground, it was about 14 months.
Okay. That's actually not bad, all things considered.
Yeah. But just lots of decisions to be made, with the, the extent of soundproofing and like all these things that, end up adding up.
Oh my God.
And, but boy, we're glad we did it.
Is the finished effect exactly what you'd hoped, like as far as the soundproofing goes in the neighborhood and all that?
Yeah, this room, you really can't hear anything.
Cool.
Which is wonderful. And the vocal room has been really great. And mm-hmm. that, so, we did the floating floor and the double, none of the walls are touching the, the framing and
right.
clip system. So, and
there's so much like A, information out there these days, and B, like bad information with all that stuff too, right? You have to really sift through it all.
Yeah.
I've been through it a few times.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a great consultant kind of guide us through this week. We were originally going to do a prefabricated wall material that had an inherent good dB masking. Mm-hmm. And then we found out that we couldn't really do it that easily here. And so I think that was probably the right thing anyway. And so that's when we hired the consultant.
Yeah, I'm sort of like, I moved into this place about 2 months ago, and I'm going to be building out sort of a room, kind of not entirely unlike what your situation is, I guess, but slightly different. And so he was over and checking it out, giving me some pointers and seeing if he's a good fit, but he seems like a good guy to,
Yeah, he's
again, like the personality thing is like important, right?
Yeah. I mean, he'll give you different options, and we like, he had did a couple bids for the soundproofing. You know, some of the numbers, you always have to check numbers just to see if, you know, if there's an easier way you can, you know, easier on the bank way to do it. And, you know, and so he was happy to come back, and he actually did an ultrasound of the room by, you know, doing a clap test to see how much decay there was. And
can you tell me a bit about recording your bass? One of the most interesting things that I find about you is how identifiable your tone is. Like, both, I know there's sort of like, I kind of think of you as like a, there's like a studio Victor, and then there's a live Victor, where it's more of like a like a wall of sound. But in the if we're just talking about studio stuff, if you're say doing, I mean, I don't even know if you do much of that kind of stuff, but like bass overdubs for somebody on your own, what kind of things do you look for in a bass sound, and how do you go about recording yourself?
Gosh, well. I do a lot of the stuff we're over, especially during the pandemic.
You know,
lots and lots of that. But I mean, I pretty much do the same thing. I've used the same strings, you know, same brand of strings, but I change them a lot.
You know, do you use steel strings or gut strings, or what's your
steel strings? And you know, so I change them like every 3 to 4 months, and which keeps them kind of bright. The fundamental pitch kind of goes away after that.
Okay, that's a regular change for an upright bass.
Yeah, it's I think it. I mean, I've been told that that's a lot. but I use the old Fishman BP-100 pickup into a Demeter tube direct, vacuum tube direct, and then. Usually mic it with you with, I usually like it kind of pointed to kind of halfway between the, the basses are inside, I would show you. Kind of near the treble F hole above the bridge a little bit. And, you know, so it's kind of, I like it a bit focused sounding, because it's always something, you know, to, it's so much more difficult to create high end versus low. And so I would much rather it start in a point where it's really kind of clean sounding. And if you need more low end, then kind of work from that. So most of the time, if I'm doing something, it's one mic. Sometimes, you know, engineers will put two mics, one that's a little higher. I'm kind of noisy on the fingerboard, you know, near the, I don't know. I mean, I think I am a little noisy, so I don't, most of the time if they put it up high, they end up kind of docking it. But you know, like either some kind of large diaphragm microphone, you know, like a, you know, U47, 67 or 87. And, or, you know, if you wanted even, I mean, I have great luck with using a 414. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the time, I've been using one of those ear trumpet labs, Nadine microphones recently. And that's just nice because it's always in the right spot and you don't have to worry about.
That's the one that actually like clips onto your bridge.
Yeah, it's just right under the bridge, and I actually been using that quite a bit for the last, probably about a year now. Just, you know, if I'm doing something at home and it's just easy to do it kind of quickly, and that's been great.
Oh, it's just cool.
Any of those mics, and then, you know, like some people will put the B&K microphone just pointed right at the bridge, or you know, just depends on what they're doing. And I like the mic placement. There's kind of an area that there's a sweet spot on. I use this Jusek bass, which is a Czech instrument. Mm-hmm. It's probably my most distinctive. You know, if there's a distinctive sound, that one since '95, pretty much like a 99% of recordings.
Okay.
And so it you know, it's, you know, it's interesting with placement of the microphone. I you know, I like it close enough to the bridge that it's almost, I always kind of, when if somebody's asking about this, to kind of compare it to a rhythm and treble pickup on a Les Paul, you know.
Oh, that's an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah, so like the higher you get, the more, you know, you're going to get a little rounder. And the lower, actually, too, you're going to start getting rounder. So if you kind of get one that's kind of like it's almost thinking of as a middle position, you're going to kind of get a nice bounce of both if you're using one microphone.
Do you have any preferences? Like I've talked to Dave Pilch on this show and Dennis Crouch and stuff, and they have like really interesting thoughts about where to stand in a room. Like Dave Pilch loves to record into a corner.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
He loves his living room. Like the corner of his living room is his favorite. Yeah. Do you have favorite spots? Or are you pretty easy going as far as like where the sound sounds best to you in the room?
I like the mic really kind of close to the instrument, you know, I don't always love a room sound that much for it because then it starts kind of complicating.
Right.
Frequencies and this room I'm in is really dead. So it's, it doesn't matter so much, but if like in a particular studio, you know, like if we can, you know, if a carpet is available or if it isn't too splashy, you know, and I I've done that thing with that David is talking about going toward a corner because then you've already got a non-repeating surface
right
in front of you. So it almost becomes a really small room, you know. That is one thing. I really do like having the mic super close to the instrument because I don't play that loudly. I always call it embouchure or whatever, you know. I don't hit it that hard. So if it's not going to splash the room.
What about your live sound? Like I've heard that you've got up to like 4 or 5 pickups on that thing. Is that true?
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. I split it in different ways. So like the, BP 100, the one that I was talking about, the Fishman, it's like their first design they made, which I really like still. And I like that one because it's a very mid-rangey kind of pointed sound, which is easy to shape. And so I'll send that.
Is that a pickup? That's an under bridge pickup?
It's actually right on the edge of the pickup. I mean, right on the edge of the bridge.
Okay.
It's like it sits between the, there's one that sits between the G and D string and the other one sits at the between the A and the E string. And so it's a very pointed sound that allows you to just, you know, it's about as like close to the string contact as you possibly can. Okay. So it's not exactly the most natural sound, but you can EQ it any way you want. And then, mm-hmm. but the Demeter DI really kind of just
focuses it.
Yeah. Really kind of focuses and makes it less nasal and harsh sounding. And so that combination kind of gives that kind of clarity that I want, but then it's still kind of pleasing with the, mm-hmm. the tube on there. So that usually gets fed to the house. Or okay. I'll ask for a little bit in my monitor as well. So I'm getting that kind of mid-range, higher detail. Then I'm using also an Underwood pickup, which was designed in the 70s.
I've heard of those, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like the classic.
Yeah, if you think of Ron Carter in the 70s.
Okay.
And so that's it actually sits between the feet and the top... And that kind of sits within the bridge, so it's almost a little bit of a compressed sound, more electric sounding. Okay. And that's kind of lower mid-range and lows. And then I run that into a small mixer, which then mixes. It's a Beasley magnetic. He's in Canada. He's
those dang Canadians.
Yeah, he's way on the eastern side.
Halifax, Moncton, St. John's. I'm Canadian. I know all the corners.
He makes this great giant magnetic pickup. I attach it right to the end of the fingerboard. And so I mix the between that and the.
How does it attach to the fingerboard?
It's this very complicated mount, it's really a great bit of engineering, you know. And so it has a clamp that goes on the bottom, underneath the fingerboard, and then also to the sides.
Okay. And,
so I mix that between the Underwood and the Beasley pickup.
Wow.
So the Beasley is wonderful because it doesn't have really a distinct sound. I mean, if you only use that, it would sound like a big, like a Gibson bass, like an EBO or you know, even a...
Okay.
Which is great in itself, but if you mix between the two pickup, you can get all of this low end, super loud, you know, nothing's going to feed back with this pickup. And then you get a little bit of detail from the Underwood, and then you give the house a bit of the... So it's really, I'm just using three. It's like it's eliminated feedback problems, you know, and just being really, really loud. And then I use a giant amplifier. And
yeah. So what do you like for amps? Like I've seen you playing through a huge stack, like a big.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to be with SWR, you know, and used like 2 410 cabinets. And now I use this Warwick makes this crazy thing that Jonas Hellborg designed, which is, you know, and if I set it all up, it's almost taller than me, you know, and it's like 215s with these coaxial horns that face each other deliberately out of phase. So it points one to the floor and then one up. And then there's this other thing that's like a 212 cabinet with also the horns. And of course they stopped making it. And, so I don't know what I'm going to use next if it stops, you know, stops working. But it's like it's two 500 watt heads, you know, which with a driven by a preamp that's modeled after like a 1073. It sounds ridiculous, but it's wonderful to be able to control the lower and upper cabinets.
And you do that so well. Like, was that how much of a learning process was that for you? Like, just sort of getting acquainted with playing at the kind of volumes that you're able to play at?
God, it was a lot of trial and error for a long time. And, you know, and I used to carry this 9-band parametric EQ that was called Mr. Tone Controls, but which also was a, it was an SWR product that they only made for a short period of time. And it was just designed for bass frequencies. It was all this, you know, you could dial anything out. And so whenever I would, like if we did a fly date and I couldn't bring my amplifier, I'd bring that EQ, which was kind of like my dialed in sound. And then, and then when I got that Beasley pickup, the magnetic, I didn't need it anymore because it was, okay. It totally changed it. And
well, it seems like you've sort of cultivated it into a sound, like a live sound that I've never seen anybody else really do. You know, like when I think of, you know, some of the times that I've seen you, I've seen you play a few small gigs around town here. And even then you're still like ripping through those cabinets and it sounds killer.
Oh, you know? Thank you.
you're from like Champaign, Urbana area, right?
Yeah. In Illinois.
Can you tell me a bit about growing up around there? Like what was bluegrass a big thing in that area? Like how did the Krause family get into the music racket?
Well, gosh. You know, Champaign is really interesting and I you know, it's a university town and lots of,
I've played at the Krannert Center a few times and man, that place is amazing.
It really is amazing. And, you know, just the amount of interesting things you could see at any day, you know, and the music department was so strong there and still is, you know, like the high schools and are crazy in terms of, you know, its devotion to the arts and just taking it seriously. And, you know, I think if I could do what I do here up there, I'd probably still be up there. Mm-hmm. Just it was such an interesting place to live in, you know, and our parents, both my sister and I would take us, you know, they would take us to everything, you know, like a totally far out, you know, 20th century music concert with, you know, multimedia events and, you know, so it was just readily available there. And both my, you know, for my sister and I, our parents asked us, what instrument do we want to play when we both turned 5, you know, and, you know, not the, you know, like it was not really a choice or anything. Like this is, you know, you start playing an instrument. And
were they musical? Like, were they, did they play?
Yeah, they dabbled in it. Yeah. I mean, like my mom's an artist, you know, did commercial art, but also painting, and just was like, you know, and does, you know, visual artist. And then my dad used to sing in the opera choruses in at the University Productions there, but not trained musically in any way. But we just, you know, they just kind of enrolled us in anything to see what we would take to. And we both, I was definitely not that athletic. My sister was a little more athletic than I was. But
Who's older between you and Allison?
I am.
You are. Okay.
So but we both really just really liked music. And I started off on piano, and then Allison actually played violin right away.
Okay.
And my parents didn't want us both playing the same instrument. So I, you know, I got first choice at the piano, and then she, you know, because there's only so many instruments you can play at five, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Contrabass, bassoon, or something like that.
And did you take to the piano, or was it not a thing that you really...
I actually did like it, you know, I liked it more after I stopped taking lessons.
A lot of people feel that way, I'm sure.
Yeah, I didn't like it, you know, and it was funny. I took piano lessons for 5 years. And started like he was just teaching me, like at the very end where I knew I wasn't going to do anymore, he was starting to teach me accompaniment stuff, like figuring out chords. And I loved that. Mm. And, you know, like with just like in the last month or something. And then after that point, I would play piano much more. But I was already starting to get, I played trumpet a little bit, like starting in fifth grade.
Okay.
And then I saw somebody playing bass one time at a middle school concert. And I
was playing upright bass.
Yeah. And I was thinking, boy, that's neat. And, you know, just because it was like a, I mean, I still remember it. I've probably told this story way too many times, but I remember seeing, you know, it was like a, it was a pretty good orchestra program at the middle school, and just lots and lots of players. And, you know, just everybody's playing violin or maybe viola, maybe one or two cellos, but there was one bass in the center. And it was just like, whoa, that's, you know, like,
that's, I know what you mean. Like it's a visual impact thing as well as sonically appealed to you.
Yeah. When I heard it, it was just like, wow, this is doing something big. So I really started on that right away. And then I also played a little bit of electric bass, but it was, I started on big one and then played, you know, kind of ever since both.
So were you like, did you have a teacher or were you just teaching yourself?
Yeah, I did. There were a couple of teachers. One who was the head of the bass department at the University of Illinois, who was very intimidating.
Okay. Really?
Yeah, Ed Krolik was his name. I don't think he's no longer with us. But was he
like a classical player?
Yeah. Okay. And, but then I ended up getting this teacher named Karen Korsmeyer, who was fantastic, and she kind of gave me this. She was a jazz player. And gave me this cassette I still have it, of all these great bass players like Ray Brown, Oscar Pettiford, Paul Chambers, Charles Mingus. There were certain tunes that I just really loved, and she would, you know, she could transcribe the whole thing out, and she was a student.
Oh man, do you remember what specific tunes were on that tape that really blew your mind?
There was. Whims of Chambers, Paul Chambers, just a great head on that. Laverne Walk, which was Oscar Pettiford, and then Things Ain't What They Used to Be, which was a duet with Ray Brown and Duke Ellington.
Did you ever get into that Money Jungle record?
I don't know if I know that.
Oh, really? It's Duke Ellington and Mingus and Max Roach. It's a trio record.
Wow.
And I just ask because it's like it's Mingus's, for me, like Mingus's greatest bass playing ever. Like he's really, and they're kind of like scrapping apparently during the session. And so there's like so much aggression in the way that he plays. It's really interesting. I thought it's one of Jay Belarose's favorite records. And I figured it would have made it to your eardrums at some point, but maybe not.
I need to check that out. What's it called again?
Money Jungle.
Money Jungle. Okay.
Yeah. It's a crazy record. It's all Ellington tunes mostly, but it's like, yeah, it's just this trio format that never seemed to have happened again. Wow. Maybe with good reason.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
But I found out that I ended up really loving Ray Brown. Mm-hmm. Like, he's probably the most.
What was it about his playing that really did it for you?
Well, just the sound was just so, you know, like, and it played so in tune and just, I don't know, facility and just, there was something about it that was just like, I fell in love with the record for me that I really, you know, like, it got me into jazz was not only the teacher was you know, introducing me to Nisa, but the Night Train.
Oscar Peterson, yeah.
Yeah.
Was jazz your thing? Is that what you were most into in those days? Or were you playing in any rock bands or anything like that?
Well, yeah, yeah. You know, I should also mention the bluegrass. You know, I used to accompany my sister. My sister would enter fiddle contests. And
so, like, was she rocking it, like, right away, like at age 5, 6 kind of thing?
Well, she was doing, like, classical violin, and then ended up doing, and she actually was in, like, there was a youth orchestra called the National Academy of Arts or something in Cura, you know, so it was like, it was crazy amount of stuff that you could do at that time in Champaign. And there was a great teacher, string teacher there named Leo Pondelik, you know, and he was actually a very intense but funny guy, yeah. You know, scariest students. But then when you met him after, and when he was not in teacher mode, he was fantastic, you know, really. Okay. And he had the whole orchestra play Arkansas Traveler.
Cool.
And she really liked that.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of the first things that introduced her to doing that. And then she entered a contest at the county fair in Champaign. And, you know, and so it kind of blossomed from that. And, you know, my mom would accompany her on guitar. And then I started playing bass. I said, well, that'd be fun to do that, you know. And I became in some ways I became a bit of a spaz. You know, it's just like, you know, well, I could do this. And, you know, it wasn't always the role, you know, appropriate role in that. And so that, you know.
Were you aware of some of the bluegrass bass, like Junior Husky and like that?
No. Okay. I mean, I became aware of them, you know, from the records that my sister would listen to, you know.
Yeah.
It's like on everything. And, you know, and so, you know, and I met him when I moved here. He was really sweet.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You know, before he passed away. And Roy, I'd never met his dad, but. So I became interested in jazz just because more so as a vehicle, you know, it became fascinating to me on how, what bass was possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not all of it I loved, but I did, you know, I still feel like that's kind of in my roots from learning so much of it. And then when I get to do,
yeah,
I it's like, oh, wow, this is familiar and fun.
So were there kids your age that could play that kind of stuff that you were able to play with?
Yeah, okay. There was actually the high school jazz band was quite good. Mm-hmm. And I actually in high school did one of the college bands. You know, when they had like bands 1 through 5 or something, I think it was 4 or 5 or something. But it was just neat that how many people were into it. And there was a great club in Champaign called Nature's Table that was just a dedicated jazz club that would play you know, there'd be happy hours, but then there'd be a set that goes from 9 until 1 pretty much every night. And so that was a great place for me to play and learn, and just it was a scene, and good time to be there.
Did you get to see any of those guys, like Ray Brown or like any of that generation of players play?
No, and unfortunately, no. I did see the Basie band, but it was right at the end of, like, Count Basie wasn't there, but I got to see Freddie Green. You know, like, he was right in front.
Oh, wow.
Which was great to
see. Amazing.
Yeah. And I met Ray Brown in the airport one time.
You did?
Yeah. And
what was that like?
It was. I just felt like I stumbled and sounded like a little dork, you know, little kid, you know, just like, I wish I'd been a little cooler than that, but you know,
you just stumbled into it. Like, he happened to be there.
I saw him, you know, he was at LaGuardia Airport, and he was taking his Gage case, you know, on his shoulder. And I said, that's Ray Brown. You know, and if I don't say anything to him, I'll regret it. You know? Yeah. And so I did, and kind of, I don't know. I wish I
probably. It wasn't your shiniest moment.
No.
That's all right.
Yeah.
You're allowed to have that happen. I mean, what's going to happen anyway? So after you graduated from high school, it seems like you must have moved to Nashville fairly soon, but there's a few years there, I guess. Like, did you go to university or?
Yeah, I did. I went to U of I, University of Illinois, and, you know, and I was doing rock bands at the time too, which I loved.
So what kind of rock bands were you playing in?
I was in this kind of crazy band called Difficult Listening.
I love it.
and it was like really kind of far out stuff. It was stuff that a friend of mine and I from high school, we wrote silly songs together, and it became, you know, there was a group of guys in that group that we played, and then it became this band that we actually played out live. So it was all original music, but it was totally kind of berserk sound, like a lot of times we kind of compare it to like Frank Zappa kind of stuff. So it was very kind of complicated music, but all the players were like jazz players too, so it was the name was fitting.
Yeah. Were you playing upright in that situation, or were you playing electric?
Yeah, I played electric in there.
Okay.
You know, I love playing electric. I don't get to do it quite as much because I've been kind of, people think of me doing the big bass. But yeah, that was a good time. So yeah, I started off as a string bass performance major, and then I figured out within the first semester that I didn't want to do that. I never thought of myself as an orchestral player, even though it'd be nice to be good at it. But I just wasn't, I don't know, I just didn't feel like it was me.
Yeah, it's good to realize that.
Yeah, and so I ended up finishing in music composition, a theory composition degree at kind of, it was just like a year after then I thought, you know, I started to kind of visit my sister who was already living here and, you know, obviously doing well by 1991.
Yeah, was her trajectory like, was it already taking off at that point?
Oh yeah, big time.
It was. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, she'd already had a couple Grammys and.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, starting to play. If not opening for people, playing a lot of, you know, it was just getting bigger and bigger at that point. And so I would join her on tours and, you know, just for fun, and I was like, wow, this could be good, you know, to do something. And during that time in college, I did actually go out and tour as a bass player for her for a little while. That was fun, but I kind of wanted to finish school, you know, and I only did it for a short period of time.
You resigned.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, you know, like I've been asked that question a bunch, you know, why don't we play together more often? And, you know, we do on some things, but it's usually, you know, like the guy that she has, Barry Bales, who's been with her forever, really is the best fit for her band.
Right.
And then if we do something that's a little, you know, if it's an Allison project, you know, outside of the band, and or if it's another project, then she's nice enough usually to call me.
She's got your number still.
Yeah, she knows. You know,
for you, was there a specific reason for the move to Nashville, or did you just kind of blindly dive in and just say, this is like the place where I'm going to find some action?
Yeah, well, there were a couple of thoughts, you know, like it was, you know, there was always a little bit of an allure of California for me. But I was already starting to kind of make some contacts here. And Paul Zahn, who was my composition professor, he's the dad of Andrea Zahn. Mm-hmm. And, he was very encouraging and saying, well, you should move to Nashville and play. And, you know, I think it would really work out for you. And he had a kind of like a weekly gig then down there, and I'd play down here with him. And then some of the allure of what my sister was doing was kind of coming into play. And I thought, well, okay, well, maybe this would be pretty fun to make a go of it, you know.
Right.
I kind of knew I wanted to play music professionally. It was interesting. I had an interesting balance between, I worked for my dad. My dad had a real estate firm, which was a lot of the time, you know, either campus housing or some investment property. And I would do the books there.
Oh.
And right out of college and part of in college. And so it was a nice balance between that part of my brain and playing music.
Right.
And I like it.
Make a few bucks too, I bet.
Yeah. And so it was kind of a nice balance of playing music that I really like to do, and then also just kind of doing that, which was nice too.
So what kind of situations were you finding yourself in when you first moved here?
Well, I mean, like what we talked about with Peter Rowan, you know.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I was kind of there, and then there was some people that kind of knew me, like Jerry kind of had me play on an early record of his. And so
at that point, did you have much recording experience? Like, had you been in the studio?
But not a huge amount.
Okay.
And you know, I mean, for me, I guess maybe that's not fair to say. I used to record. I mean, I record myself, like, you know, I had a little Fostex X15 cassette recorder.
Cool. And, me too.
Yeah. You know, thousands and thousands of hours of just, okay, this is when you play, you know, when you press record, you play better, you know? And,
right.
And so in that regard, yes, I had lots of, you know, of feeling okay, but not in a professional situation, no, not a huge amount, but I knew what it felt like to have what the red light meant.
Right. That's important.
Yeah. And so that never really intimidated me. It just said, okay, this is a nicer environment and somebody else is doing it for me.
Great. It's just a glorified X15.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have. Yeah. So there was just starting. It was kind of, you know, and some people were kind of saying, okay, well, yeah, he's good at this. And somebody had said that really it takes, it was Rich Adler who engineered Every Time You Say Goodbye record, the Allison record. Mm-hmm. He said something that was so true. He says, like, when you first move to Nashville, it takes about 2 years to start really branching out from the context that you already. Mm-hmm. And I thought that to be pretty true. And it was a good time to move there, you know, because it was kind of a boom in the recording, and it was actually kind of, Nashville was on its way up.
Right.
At that point too, in terms of being, I don't know, I mean, it seems like every city has its waves, you know, and it was like it had been maybe down, and, you know, and like 90s country was becoming huge at that point. And so it was a good time to, it was a good time to move there, you know. Like,
was there a ton of like local gigging work for you, or were you mostly?
Yeah, there was some.
Okay.
Yeah, there was some. I mean, like singer songwriters, and then some people that I'd met through my sister or through, you know, people that I already knew, you know, and a handful of some jazz gigs. I kind of decided that I wouldn't take necessarily everything, you know. I was kind of looking for a path to kind of either get into recording or doing this kind of work.
Yeah.
Versus doing everything. And not that it was easy to be choosy, but it was kind of like, okay, well, if I keep doing one thing that I don't particularly like, it'll just lead to more things that I don't really like, you know? And so, I mean, if that sounds, well, it doesn't sound arrogant, but I was just—
No, that's totally true. Yeah, of course. Was there enough jazz situations here for you to feel satisfied in that way or not really?
I don't know. You know, I didn't really end up playing. It was like almost kind of the jazz career kind of went away when right. I moved here.
Yeah.
And some of that was okay. You know, and it's funny, I'm playing more jazz now than I ever have in Nashville.
Yeah.
In fact, after today, I've been doing some stuff with Jeff Coffin and Jordan Pearlson as a trio. Just we're getting together this afternoon.
All right.
Yeah. But that's fun. You know, just to kind of exercise that. You know, and it's fun. I do love it still.
How did the gig with Lyle Lovett come around? Because you sort of ended up playing with him since what, 94 or something
94,
like that?
94. Yeah.
Was he living here at the time?
No, well, he's actually never lived here. He's always lived in Texas. But yeah. I had, when I was in college, I remember when the Large Band record came out, Lyle Lovett's Large Band record came out in 1990. And I would see him on The Tonight Show or I'd hear a couple of things. And I goes, that guy's cool.
That was a very cool concept that he had, or whoever's idea that was of putting that kind of music all together was pretty ingenious.
Yeah, I think I must have seen him on Tonight Show because he was on constantly at that time period.
Yeah.
And I remember I bought that record and I go, wow, you know, and I said, well, wouldn't that be fun? And I kept that in my mind kind of from then on, you know, when I moved to Nashville, I said, well, maybe I could pursue that. And so I kind of asked.
Oh, wow.
Lots of people. Okay, who are his people? And like, oh, okay, this person plays with him or this person plays with him. And
were there guys in his band at the time that lived in Nashville?
Oh, yeah, like Matt Rawlings, you know, on piano.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And then I kind of found out who managed him. They found that, you know, that Ken Levitan managed him. And Tony Brown, of course, was involved with his career. And so I kind of figured out who to ask. And I said, you know, like in Ken Levitan's person, there was a publicist that Allison had at the time who said, oh, I'll help you write a letter. And I, you know, I wrote a letter to him saying,
wow,
band, or I'd love to, you know, if he's ever in the need of a bass player for that.
Yeah.
And I had met Ken and then Will Botwin, who was also a manager in the New York side of his career. I don't know. I remember trying to get like multiple people handled at the time.
I bet.
And so I met him and Will had heard me play, kind of sit in. It was another one of these times where I'd sat in with Allison on her show just for a song or two. And he happened to be at the show at the Bottom Line. And I said, oh yeah, well, you know, I love, you know, what Lyle does if he ever needs that. So I was, you know, I was really kind of ambitious in terms of finding that.
Wow. That's so cool, man, that you actually pursued it.
Yeah. And so I remember I was out, I was working with Peter Rowan and we weren't working very much. And Ken, when I talked to him initially, he said, oh, you know, he's already got somebody with, you know, keep you in mind. And then I thought, okay, well, let me just call him again and see what's going on, even if it's not for Lyle. And I caught him at the exact right time.
Wow.
And I said, oh, well, okay, yes, Lyle may need somebody. And so then we started this dialogue that went on for about a month. I talked to various people. I talked to his musical director. Just, yeah, I think they were kind of like, well, who is this guy? And Tony Brown had heard me play one time. And so he vouched for me saying, oh, yeah, this could probably do it.
Had you worked with Matt Rawlings at that point?
No, I'd never worked with him.
Okay.
And, but I, of course, heard of him and, you know, and heard him.
Yeah.
It ended up being something where I found out that I got the gig 10 days before the tour was going to start.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I was like, you know, so he had five records up to that point, I think.
Yeah. So you had a shit ton of material to learn. And
oh, gosh. Yeah. It was a ton of material to learn. And the guy who was on the gig already was fantastic. It was this guy, John. It was his first record that he had done with upright bass. So the record needed upright bass.
Yeah.
And it was a guy, John Leftwich, who had played on the record, but decided he didn't want to stay on
tour.
And I said, okay. And so I had to learn all his stuff. And he came out. They wanted to make a transition. So John played the first like six shows and I watched him just to see what he did. And then we kind of switched. And then
wow.
Then I play the shows, you know. And
yeah, and then he would watch you and say, "You're doing that wrong."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was really cool how it all turned out. It was an exciting time.
So was there ever an actual audition? Like, did you have to show up at a rehearsal and like do your thing, or you just got the gig and you had to
the gig and just had to do it?
Yeah.
And you know, so it was just based on, you know, people vouching for me, and that's been kind of his organization. You know, it's like I remember I had a I met Lyle before playing. He wanted to know how long my hair was. You know, like how long is his hair?
Priorities, man.
Yeah, yeah, you know, so you know, I guess I came across the right way.
As short as you want it to be.
Yeah, yeah.
If you had to say, you know, a couple things or one thing, like about keeping a gig like that going for so long. So that was 94. That's,
yeah.
According to my advanced mathematical skills, that's 26 years.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Yeah. That's incredible. How have you managed to juggle that? Like, has that ever been a thing where it's hindered you from doing what you want to do or anything like that?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, like if you do anything for a long period of time, you know, the same thing is like you'll get a lot of the same results, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's been tours where I didn't do it, you know, when we were, you know, we've got kids. So there were certain tours that when we were having kids that I opted not to go out as long or, you know, or especially the, you know, the ones that happened during the summertime.
Yeah. Has there been a lot of turnaround? Like how... From that band that you first joined in 94, is there anyone else that's still in the band?
Yeah, there's a couple, couple people, you know, and some people that have been around. You know, like I was the young guy, I mean, the new guy for a long time.
Yeah.
And still when he introduces everyone, you know, like he's been talking about how long people are playing, you know, I'm still not one of the, I mean, I don't know, I guess I'm becoming one of the older guys.
And what's he like as a guy to work for? And has your role, like, are you the MD now or are you just...
Well, there was one summer where I was, so there was a couple, you know, and then we, I don't know, we all kind of, I don't know, we've got checks and balances in that band, you know, like between, for the people that have been there a long time and the ones that are detail oriented, you know, we get asked to do this, you know, I mean, he's in charge, you know. And
does he get involved musically? Like, is he involved in the arrangements and things like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. I think, but it was never, you know, somebody put it well, I was kind of like band quarterback or translator.
Okay. Yeah. Like everyone's so high caliber in that band. It's not like you have to ride the drummer about how to play the drums.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It was never really that, you know, and
right.
And I could feel sometimes it would be easy to overstep your bounds, mm-hmm. and just, you know, because everybody's there, and you know, that's probably one of the reasons why it's hard to imagine not doing it in some ways, because the calibers, I mean, like it spoiled me right away.
Probably one of the classiest acts in touring biz, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and just everyone is, you know, just a precision, and we never rehearse. You know, I think the most we ever rehearsed was for a tour in, excuse me, 95, where we, you know, was more of a production rehearsal than anything else. We rehearsed for like 2 or 3 days, but now we never do. You know, it just shows up and it's just pretty much where we'd have left off.
So in those 26 years, have you ever, like, has there ever been a chunk of time when he hasn't toured or anything?
Yeah, there were, you know, like certain years, like a crazy amount. Mm-hmm. You know, and then some years not very much at all. And
do you get a lot of notice about how that's going to play out, or do you just kind of have to be obligated to him
for... Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, it's nice. I mean, they're really disappointed if you can't do it, you know.
Right.
And sometimes you do have to kind of give advance, you know, notice on stuff like that. And you know, there's been different managements over the years. Some give you way too much notice. Like, what are you doing a year from now?
You right.
know, I don't know, you know, or other ones that are like, okay, well, we have this in a week. Can you do it? You know, so
both of those can be difficult.
Yeah. Both of those can be difficult. You know,
when you do other stuff, like say, you know, I'd love to talk to you for a minute about the Frizzell stuff that you did, which was a real like chunk of time where you played on a bunch of his
Yeah.
You know, my favorite records of his really are all with you on it, or in that era anyway. There's like five or six in a row and you're on at least three or four of them. Was that something that interfered at all, like with the Lyle Lovett situation?
Not very often. And, okay. You know, and there was sometimes what, you know, and at that time period, it was less of a rotation of players, like for me, for the bass chair. And so I did kind of miss out on some of the Bill stuff a little bit more the other way around.
What was the first Frizzell thing you did? Was that Nashville?
Yeah, it was Nashville.
Okay. And so how did that project come together? I've had Bill on the show, actually, and he talked a bit about that. But had you played with him before or anything?
No.
Or did that just come out of the blue?
And I'd really never heard of him.
Probably. Okay.
And there was a couple people that they were doing, I believe it tied to Kyle Lenning, who was part of Elektra Asylum at that time, for, you know, in partnership, I think, with Nunza. Somehow he was instrumental in that.
Okay. And
there were enough people that kind of thought, oh, okay, you know, they originally weren't going to have bass, and then they were suggesting bass. You know, it was probably good to have bass on it. And there were enough people in that camp and who had already been hired saying, oh, well, Victor would be really good at this because he can kind of, you know, he's done a lot of bluegrass and country, but also knowledge and jazz, you know, can kind of be a little bit of both. And, you know, and so I got recommended for that. And I remember hearing about, you know, people's eyes lighting up. Oh, you're going to do that. You know, it's like, oh, yeah. It seems like, you know, and I talked to him on the phone one time. He seemed like a nice guy.
Yeah. Very nice, very quiet.
And I hadn't heard any of the music prior to what, you know, it's funny, for that record and a couple other records, it seemed like, well, if he was going to send me music ahead of time, it always got to me like after I had already started on something, or like a day after I had left to go do it.
Really?
And so I didn't hear anything we did. And I remember the first day, it was just, we started playing. There was a tune that didn't make it on the record. That's really cool. And
where'd you do that record?
Sound Emporium.
Okay.
Yeah, Sound Emporium A. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really amazing. You know, it's just like...
Immediately. Yeah.
And, you know, kind of like what I was saying about with the drummers, where you kind of feel like, oh, okay, I know what to do here.
Right.
Like, this is totally comfortable and everything is laid out what you're supposed to do here.
With his music, like, I know that he kind of gets extremely involved in the arrangements, obviously, and like writes parts out for people. Was he providing you with stuff for you to play? He was. Wow. Okay.
I mean, there was a lot of notation and that kind of stuff. And
are you a good reader? You must be.
I wouldn't say I'm a great reader. You know, like if I can have a couple of days that part of my brain comes back, but like you black page, you know, I get scared and then after a while it comes back.
Okay. But he was laying notation on you.
Yeah.
Okay.
But nothing really hard.
Okay.
Like most of the stuff would just be like, like quarter notes and eighth notes and no crazy dotted tied figures in there.
And so the core of that band was you, Bill, I guess Jerry Douglas, and was it Sam Bush playing mandolin on that?
No, it was Adam Steffi.
Adam Steffi. Okay.
Yeah.
Was there anybody else that was sort of core?
Ron Block played.
Oh, yeah.
Pat Bergeson on a couple things.
He and plays harmonica, or what is he?
He played harmonica on that.
Okay.
And then, but Jerry actually came into he was not on the first round of sessions. Jerry came on the second round of the opening tune that was on the second round.
So you did one session, then they all went away, and then you reassembled to. Yeah. Okay. Was that for any particular reason, or?
I think just tunes or one other element. And the first session was longer, and then the second one was just a couple of days.
When that came together, like clearly that record was magical on a lot of levels. You know, I felt it as a fan and music listener, and I'm sure you did as a musician because it comes across that way. Was there talk about it becoming like a thing with a touring band and stuff? Or, I mean, Bill changes his...
Oh, yeah.
He seems to take left turns like all the time. Yeah, so like, was that just a thing? And then he was done and wanted to do something else?
We didn't do very much. I mean, there's just a couple shows. Gosh, what was it? Was it Sessions on Something Street? Remember that great program that was
That a New York thing?
Yeah. David Byrne hosted that show.
Okay.
For that particular time, we did that one show, and then there was a handful of dates, maybe like four or five.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, just of
wow.
With Jerry, myself, and Bill.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a great show at St. Anne's Cathedral. Yeah, it was very short. It's the same way with the Gone Just Like a Train record, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a totally different concept, but equally as inspired and
awesome. Yeah, that's
awesome.
My favorite. I think that's
yeah. Can you tell me anything about that session?
Yeah, you know, that was the one with Jim Keltner. And I remember we rehearsed at a place called the Alley Cat in Los Angeles. And, you know, and I remember going, and it was my first experience with Jim. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is nice. You know, and, you know, but when we got into the studio and I heard his sense of how to make drums sound, it was just like, whoa, this is...
It's otherworldly. Yeah. And that record is like, it's on display, like on basically no other record, I think, of his.
Yeah. It was so interesting to play with him. And he had these little, at the time, you know, and then any time that I've played with him after that point, it's like a different thing he's into.
Right.
And like this particular one, he was into these things called stoms.
Oh yeah, the toms with snares, right?
Yeah, toms with snares, but little bitty toms. So they sounded like you know, like nothing else, like a totally other snare happening. You know, and then another time he was into these plastic Mastro snare drums, and and then this calfskin bass drum, you know, with actual fur on it. And
on that record, are you playing through amps and stuff, or are you just playing acoustic?
I don't think I plugged into an amp, but it's a combo of the
pickups and
the big, just the one BP-100.
Okay.
I think I was going into an Evil Twin DI on that one, and then just mic there. But that was at O. Henry Studios in I think off of, was it Lancashire, in Los Angeles or Burbank.
Okay. And done like in a couple of days kind of thing, or?
Yeah, like 3 days, 3 or 4
yeah.
days.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's funny. I have all of the outtakes too of that record.
Oh yeah.
DAT of all things. Like,
wow. Was that mostly just like you guys, like Bill had heads and tunes and then you would just play for hours kind of thing? Is that how it went down?
Yeah.
Nice.
And because we rehearsed a little bit, but then, you know, it didn't, some of the stuff, you know, was because like, as you said, you know, a lot of the stuff is arranged. So some of it kind of played itself.
Yeah.
Like on Look Out for Hope, that was kind of that one had less of an arrangement than like Blues for Los Angeles, you know, where it was.
Right. What about Good Dog, Happy Man? That's actually probably my favorite of those ones that we've talked about. I kind of studied Steel with Greg Lee. So that record for me, like from a Steel point of view, that's like one of my favorite records of all time too.
Yeah. Oh, that's, it's a toss up really between those. I think there was something magical about the recording of the Good Dog. I mean,
Gone Just Like a Train.
Yeah, Gone Just Like a Train record. That was kind of like, I have different memories of it, but the Good Dog, Happy Man record, that was, I mean, it felt like, okay, we're familiar as a trio and now we have these really other beautiful expressive elements that are now happening.
Was that the first time that Greg had been in that situation?
With Bill?
Yeah.
I think it might have been. You know, they may have done something before. It was funny when I was I was mentioning that trio with Jerry and myself, and we did those handful. I think that's where they may have first met on one of those dates.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's been a fruitful relationship, those two.
Yeah.
What are you doing these days? Like musically, like what's around the corner for you? You've got this new place. Are you producing records these days?
Producing stuff and I'm just on whoever will have me these start,
Is the Lyle Lovett touring machine starting to rev up at all, or is it just Deadsville out there?
They had talked about putting some dates on the calendar, but then, you know, it keeps, you know, you never know one.
Yeah.
And who's going to come?
Right.
I think all of us have a little glimmer of thinking that there's light at the end of the tunnel with, you know, the vaccine happening, and, you know, we're hearing about little things all around that maybe things will start to pick up. But
as far as like local shows, do you have any? I'm trying to think. I think the last time I saw you was I think you were playing at the 12 South Tap Room is where I saw you last.
Oh gosh, a while ago. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good 2 or 3 years ago probably.
Was that with Jim Oblon?
Or was it was probably with Jim Oblon. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing like a weekly get together at the studio and playing really loud.
With Jim?
Yeah, it's great.
I thought he moved away. I thought he doesn't live here anymore.
He did. You know, he had plans to do that, and then all the pandemic happened, and he had an arrangement, and then so he just ended up staying.
Oh, okay.
So we've been playing together as a trio with him and myself and Pete Abbott on drums.
Nice.
Yeah, probably that same group that you saw. And
okay.
Yeah, just really fun.
Yeah. I loved that gig. It was great.
Yeah.
Who else, like locally, do you play with regularly? Or like, I mean, I know these days nobody, but like in theory.
I mean, like the trio I mentioned with Jordan Pearlson and Jeff Coffin, we've been doing.
Right.
That a bit. And that's fun because there's no other harmonic information other than me and, you know, and Jeff. So it's like it's there's a lot of space, you know, there's no other chordal instrument.
Where would you guys do that? Like a Rudy's or something?
We did the thing last year with Nir Felder and Keith Carlock and Jeff and I. We did that at Rudy's and a couple other places. But, okay. You know, I mean, mostly it's just like streaming things right now.
And, yeah.
You know, and I did a thing with my group at Rudy's a couple months ago. And then
when you say your group, who's in that?
Well, I do that, you know, for the solo album materials. I do that with Todd Lombardo on electric guitar and sometimes electric guitar. And then Robert Crawford on drums and great keyboard player, DeMarco Johnson.
And cool.
And so that's kind of some of that material. And
is there going to be a Victor Kraus record? They've been few and far between. There hasn't been one for a long time.
And then I did that duet record with Maeve Gilchrist. And
that's a beautiful record.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to make them. I'd like it when other people pay for them. You know,
right.
You know, I mean, when there's a label support to do it.
Yeah. You don't feel a burning desire to do solo records. You're happy to play on other people's records.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's funny. I think it will probably come back, you know, to do it. I mean, I have material to do it, but I think what I like about those solo, you know, I have trouble finishing things, you know, like in terms of my own stuff. And I think I'm really proud of those records existing because I actually finished them, you know, because it's hard. Yep.
Lee Townsend cracking the whip.
Yeah, yeah. you know, now that I have the space and there's been enough stuff to do and having kids, three kids is, you know,
oh, you got three kids. Yeah, man.
Yeah. So it's not as easy, but you know, now that I have the space and it's actually detached from the rest of your life. And,
right.
You know, this building's been up since, you know, where I've actually been in it since just October. So it's,
it's pretty nice.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get onto something.
Well, thanks, man. Thanks so much for spending all this time with me. I know I took up a lot of your time, but I just had a lot of stuff to ask you about.
Yeah,
I hope that's okay.
Oh, absolutely. I'm flattered that you want me to be part of this.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Victor, and we'll hopefully see you soon.
All right, see you.
All right, that was my conversation with Victor Kraus. Thank you guys so much for listening and sticking around with me right to the end. I really appreciate it. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.